and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. It's the last weekend before the US election, and at this late stage, it seems nothing separates the two candidates in the polls. In fact, last night, both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris ended up campaigning not just in the same swing state of Wisconsin, worth 10 electoral college votes, but in the same city of Milwaukee. They were less than 10 kilometres apart physically, but politically, of course, remaining far apart. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue has the details.
Ah, what a crowd this one is, huh?
It's been a rough week for the former president, on the back foot over comments about women, Hispanics, and a suggestion that one opponent should face something akin to a firing squad. The crowd got some unusual treatment, a large gun-like object firing T-shirts into the audience. But it was the usual message from the candidate.
We're leading just about, I think, all seven swing states we're leading. But don't listen to me now. Don't listen. Just pretend we're one down, right? We're 1 point down, please. We don't want to say, oh, we don't have to vote today, Alice, because he's leading. No, don't do that. We've seen that stuff happen. We don't want to do that.
His bad week continued when repeated sound problems ended up with the crowd shouting, fix the mic.
Oh, the mic. Yeah, I think the mic stinks.
That drew some expletives from the former president and him saying he'd fire the contractors.
Make no mistake, we will win.
Here in Wisconsin and across the other six key swing states, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris are neck and neck. That's why they're ending up in the same places all the time. This time the vice president just 6 miles away. She was backed by some big celebrities, including the rapper Cardi B.
Did not have faith on any candidates until she joined the race and said the things that I wanted to hear, that I want to see next in this country, all right?
For her part, Kamala Harris accused Donald Trump of being unhinged, but also focused on the economy, something where she has lagged Donald Trump in the polls.
I will give a middle-class tax cut to over 100 million Americans. We will enact the first ever federal ban on corporate price gouging on groceries and fight to make sure that hardworking Americans can actually afford a place to live.
It's now a battle for every last vote. No one knows how this one will end, or indeed whether next Tuesday will be the end of it, with fears of lawsuits and worse.
The BBC's Gary O'Donoghue reporting, and as Gary mentioned at the end of that piece there, the fear of lawsuits is very real. Dozens have already been filed, particularly in the swing states, as we reported on this programme a few days ago. Now the Attorney General of Arizona, another swing state worth 11 electoral college votes, says her office is investigating whether comments made by Mr. Trump, also alluded to there in Gary's report, violated state law. Chris Mayers is a Democrat, and she told local reporters that Mr. Trump's comments may violate the state laws prohibiting death threats. Here's a clip of what Mr. Trump said in an interview with Tucker Carlson in Glendale, Arizona on Thursday. He was speaking about former Republican Senator Liz Cheney.
Let's put her with a rifle standing there with 9 barrels shooting at her, okay? Let's see how she feels about it. You know, when the guns are trained on her face. You know, they're all war hawks when they're sitting in Washington in a nice building saying, oh, gee, Will, let's send 10,000 troops right into the mouth of the enemy. But she's a stupid person. And I used to have, I'd have meetings with a lot of people, and she always wanted to go to war with people.
Well, in response to criticism, Mr. Trump's campaign team has been saying that he was criticising Liz Cheney for being a hawk or a warmonger. His supporters say it comes under protected free speech. But Kamala Harris picked up the row herself in comments she made in Milwaukee last night, saying such remarks disqualified Donald Trump from the presidency.
He has increased his violent rhetoric, Donald Trump has, about political opponents. And in great detail, suggested rifles should be trained on former Representative Liz Cheney. This must be disqualifying. Anyone who wants to be president of the United States who uses that kind of violent rhetoric is clearly disqualified and unqualified to be president.
Well, let's speak live now to Dr. Leslie Vinger-Murray, who's director of the US and Americas program at the Chatham House think tank. Leslie, thanks so much for coming on. First, a quick word on these latest comments and threats of legal action, because this is something we've seen increasingly across this campaign. How important might the courts become after this election?
I think the courts are going to be very active, very busy. Undoubtedly, there will be calls for recounts in anything that's even on the margins, anything that's close, which if the polls are right, a big if, but if they are right, then we should see a lot of very close outcomes in a number of key swing states where it really does matter. And challenges, sure. And, you know, to be very honest here, there's nothing wrong with the legal process. The problem is when you start going extra legal, when you start inciting violence, stoking division. And most people, right? Most people in the United States are very moderate. Even on either side of the aisle, they will be dismissive of this. Most people won't like the rhetoric. But there are people that we know have been inspired by Donald Trump's language. We've seen this. This is, it's not an allegation. It's a fact. We saw this surrounding the last U.S. election. And so there is a deep concern that some people will take this kind of language, however it's intended.
Although, of course,
they will read it as it said and take it as a signal, as a request to use violence. And it's very damaging.
Although I should mention that, of course, Joe Biden has been in trouble for comments he's made in the past few days as well. So there's sort of criticism
on both sides. We have to be very careful about calling equality on the kinds of claims that are made. There's a fundamental difference between anything that approaches incitement of violence and something which, again, not politically wise, not even accurate, but to speak out against a set of voters for who they support is not smart politics, but it is fundamentally different.
Okay, good point.
Implicitly citing violence.
All right. You mentioned how important the US legal system might be after these elections. Are you confident it can handle it? Or will it itself, the legal system, be drawn into politics? Because so many legal figures in the United States are overtly political, aren't they? They're elected positions or positions given by political figures.
You know, we had several legal challenges across multiple states in the 2020 elections, and every reason to believe that those cases were handled according to the highest standards. There have been efforts to appoint judges and to undermine the independence of those processes. But I think right now there is still a remarkable degree of confidence that if the courts are used, that those questions, any concern about the closeness of a vote, of the voting count, of the process, of the outcome, will be dealt with fairly. We saw the decision that just came out of Pennsylvania, very fair decision, right, which was aimed at ensuring that as many Americans as possible have the right to vote, regardless of who they vote for. So that is, you know, yet another sign that in a very difficult, highly polarized electorate with a lot of divisiveness, a lot of difficult language, disinformation, we know the difficulties, but nonetheless, the court made a very independent decision in support of democracy.
You're referring to the Supreme Court overnight clearing the way for Pennsylvania to count thousands of votes that Republicans had wanted to be set aside. We don't know exactly what's going to happen there. But Leslie, I mean, all the polls are saying this vote is too tight to call in various different states, but nationally as well. Do you believe that is the case? Or might we be in a situation where we've been before, where the polls have actually been wrong?
I think that there will be surprises. And we've heard people like Nate Silver say, you know, the one thing that's very unusual is how close the polls are time and time again. And so undoubtedly there will be surprises. And as we know, what you can't really tell, first of all, it's hard to reach everybody in polling. And secondly, in an election like this, where there is such polarization, where the rhetoric is very difficult, and it's not only from leaders, it's from communities, there are a lot of people that simply aren't going to tell us how they're going to vote. Mm. And that's on both sides of the aisle. And then there are a lot of people that are, you know, will they vote? And we're seeing in Pennsylvania, low propensity voters turning out to vote early. That's something, you know, generally in the past, low propensity voters Donald Trump has been good at mobilizing this. In this election, it looks like Democratic registered Democrats who are low propensity voters are turning out early to vote. So there are a lot of things that might not align with those sort of headline polls. And people on the ground in swing states are hyper aware of how much their votes matter. And that is going to affect their decision about whether to vote and about who to vote for.
Of course, a lot of people still have those scenes in their minds from January 2021 when a mob besieged the Capitol building. And we've heard in recent days, the past few hours, I think, from top election officials in the state of Georgia. They've been telling the BBC that they've got preparations for what they're calling potential turbulence during and after election day. I mean, I guess that could be the situation all over the country, potentially. They're talking about having panic buttons and so on in official buildings.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, there is the potential for significant election-related violence. There's certainly the potential when January 6th, 2025 comes around for there being some sort, if there's a Harris win, there's certainly the potential that there will be violence surrounding when Congress convenes in a special joint session to certify that vote. But there are, as you noted, this is a story that people are anticipating, preparing for. And so I think that is a very good sign, right? It came by surprise last January 6th. There was no preparation. This time it's been declared a national special security day by the Department of Homeland Security. There will be measures in place. It isn't what anybody would hope to see. But I think that there is a level of awareness and vigilance, which is very important in an election that's contested and where it is so polarized and where one candidate is actively stoking division and really targeting very high level individuals in ways that some people will be interpreted as being, inviting or at least accepting the use of violence.
All right, we must leave it there. But many thanks indeed for joining us live. That's Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri, their director of the US and Americas program at the Chatham House think tank. And we'll be returning to the US elections later in this program. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, how does China feel about Russia's flourishing relationship with North Korea? More than 10,000 North Korean troops have been sent to Russia, potentially to train and fight in Ukraine. The Pentagon, NATO and Kiev have all expressed concern about that. But is the move also giving China a headache? Beijing has long been Pyongyang's most important ally, providing trade, diplomatic support and military aid to Kim Jong-un. But Chinese President Xi Jinping has also been frustrated with North Korea and the instability it brings, particularly with its nuclear weapons program and threats to annihilate South Korea. Our China correspondent Laura Bicker took a trip to the border area where China, North Korea and Russia all meet.
Dozens of curious Chinese tourists have travelled hundreds of miles for a chance to see three countries at one time. Here in the northeast, China owns just a sliver of land and is sandwiched between Russia and North Korea. Tour groups huddle together on the top of a 12-storey tower to take photos next to three overlapping flags on the wall. Peering at their Korean neighbours seems to be the main attraction.
North Korea has always been our neighbour, but to be able to see how they live makes me feel how prosperous and strong our country is.
I feel as a Chinese woman, I am very proud. There are no borders among the peoples.
Everybody's good friends.
Yeah.
This view might be overly optimistic, Like the Chinese territory she has travelled to see, Beijing is caught between its neighbours, allies that appear to be spiralling out of its control. Fears of the growing friendship between Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un have peaked in the last few weeks. The US has said it's seen evidence that Pyongyang has sent 3,000 troops to Russia for a possible deployment to Ukraine, claims we put to the Chinese Foreign Ministry.
Now the floor is open to questions.
What is China's reaction to having both its allies and its close neighbours potentially involved in a conflict in Ukraine? And can China really claim that it is absolutely neutral in this war when President Xi stands shoulder to shoulder with President Putin?
On the Ukraine crisis, China's position is constant and clear. That is, that China hopes all parties to de-escalate the situation and promote political settlement.
Back at the border, as tourists photograph the bridge that links Russia and North Korea, the atmosphere is friendly. But this deepening alliance is not in President Xi's best interests. Christopher Green from the International Crisis Group explains.
The Chinese are concerned that Russia might share with North Korea the kind of military technology that could lead to instability on China's northeastern border. And destabilization on some level could even benefit Vladimir Putin in a way it really would not benefit Xi Jinping.
Oh, we're still being followed? Yeah, they're still behind us.
Our presence at the border was noticed by the police, and while it seems tourists are welcome, journalists are not.
Yeah, so they've just blocked the road to the port, which is usually a sign that they don't want us to go there. Time to get out.
We were in public areas at all times, and yet the team was stopped, repeatedly questioned, followed, and our footage was deleted. It seems this topic is sensitive to China. Still followed, we head to the airport. Beijing does not want to be seen as part of what some in the West have labelled an axis of evil. If President Xi continues to stand back, he risks an emboldened Kim ramping up tensions further. South Korea is already looking to NATO and the US to intervene. China now seems to be stuck in the middle as Western anxiety grows.
Laura Bicker reporting there. Now, the UN's COP16 has been taking place in Colombia this week, not to be confused with COP29, which, of course, is taking place in Azerbaijan this month. COP, or Council of Parties 16, has been all about conserving biodiversity. COP29 is about climate change, so they are related but different. There's been a bit of a breakthrough in Colombia as the establishment of a permanent consultative body to the UN, drawn from indigenous communities around the world, has been approved, and cheers erupted as Susana Mohammed, of the president of COP16, announced that decision.
So I'll ask the parties if you are ready to adopt this document. As I see no party asking for the floor, so it is adopted.
There you go, a historic moment. Well, as we've been hearing this week, more than a quarter of the world's animals and plant species are thought to be at risk of extinction. So how can indigenous people help shape policies that might protect them? I've been speaking to Maya Christina Yoma, who's from the Sami nomadic community in the far north of Norway. She's also a member of the governing council at the Sami parliament. And she began by giving us her reaction to the creation of a permanent indigenous consultative body at the UN.
I am very glad that the states finally agreed to establish this and are putting forward this work and to ensure that the participation of the indigenous peoples is in the biodiversity governance. So this is something we have worked for very long and something the indigenous people has been fighting for. So this is a very good step in actually achieving and acknowledging our contributions to biodiversity governance and including of our traditional knowledge. So yes, this is something to celebrate.
And so what does it mean then for indigenous groups in terms of their ability to influence policy? What perspective do groups such as yours have that might help everybody understand the environment better?
The indigenous peoples are the experts of the land. We have lived on and with the land for centuries and for generations. It's a good step forward and will help to protect that biodiversity, but also safeguarding our distinct rights and their cultural heritage.
And in terms of specifically the issue of biodiversity and fears that we're losing so much of that, have you noticed in your own community, this is in northern Norway, isn't it, in the Arctic really, have you noticed the difference already that some of these changes have had?
Yes, we see the loss of biodiversity and the loss of land and waters. It's happening very fast, and it is connected to new infrastructure and especially constructions of the so-called green energy. And also we see the effects of the climate change already. We see that it's getting more warmer. The weather is more unpredictable. Suddenly it's starting to rain in the middle of the winters, and we see new species that comes in our lands and waters.
And so obviously this new grouping involves indigenous groups from all over the world, from really different backgrounds and environments. What do you all have in common, and how do you manage to work together?
Even though we come from different parts of the world, we have the common connection to the land and waters, and we know how to manage them in our own homelands. But we also see the same threats, such as climate change and new interests in our land and exploiting. We have a common concern, but we also have the same will to contribute on this level. And I'm very excited to see the work starting, and I think that our contribution is welcomed, but also something we need.
Maja Christina Jomar there from the Sami community in the far north of Norway. Welcome back to NewsHour. The World Health Organization says it's resuming its delayed polio vaccination program in Gaza today, but it says it can only reach children in Gaza City, which means potentially thousands will still not get their second dose, which puts all children in Gaza at risk of the debilitating disease. The entire health system in Gaza has collapsed over the past year, and the BBC's Michelle Hussein spoke to Rosalia Bolan from UNICEF about what she and her colleagues are seeing there.
My education expert, the education team here, has counted 20 schools that were turned into shelters that have been hit in less than a two-week time span. And that results in a very, very high casualty toll, including many children. And the second thing is that those who do survive those bombings are prevented from accessing care. Hospitals are under attack. They're cut off supplies. They can barely function. More generally, the North has been under a siege for a month now, which means that they've been denied basic aid, life-saving supplies, and we really struggle to bring supplies to them. We don't get green light to go. And diseases and the sanitary situation is abhorrent. Just to illustrate, last Thursday I was in the office with my colleague, and we received a phone call from a family who's originally from the North. They're now in the south of Gaza, and they were desperate. They were pleading for help. They say there's three orphan children in the north in Jabalia in a residential building that had been hit. Their parents have been killed, so these children are on their own. They did survive the bombing. They're ages 4, 7, and 10. But the problem is that these children have fractures, including leg fractures. And so they somehow got the number of one of my colleagues, and they've been asking UNICEF for help. We will be working with the World Health Organization to try to medically evacuate these children. And then we'll see if we can reunite them possibly with their relatives, with their extended family here in the south.
What is your call to Israel? Because the bombings that you're talking about of schools and residential buildings, I assume that you are talking about the Israeli army.
Most simply is an immediate and sustainable ceasefire now without delay, an end to the bombings, but also the release of the hostages.
Amid all of this, for the polio vaccination campaign to be restarting in parts of northern Gaza, how is that possible?
what we've been doing is to develop what we call micro plans in humanitarian jargon to try to reach as many shelters as possible. We have a humanitarian pause from 6 a.m. to 4 p.m. today and over the next 2 days. There's been important displacement from the most northern part of Gaza to Gaza City. So we want to use that to try and reach those children who have been displaced. There's 106 sites throughout northern Gaza where we will be conducting the vaccination campaign, but we need to reach a target 90% coverage to really be able to interrupt the transmission of the virus.
And that was Rosalia Bolland from UNICEF, the UN Agency for Children. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. A huge recovery and clear-up operation is underway in eastern Spain, the region of Valencia, following catastrophic floods and landslides earlier this week. The number of people known to have been killed has risen to at least 211. But some people are still missing, and there are fears now that the number could end up being even worse. Thousands of people have volunteered to help the recovery effort, clearing the streets and homes, and crucially, getting supplies and assistance to those made homeless by the floods. This morning, the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said that more help was on the way to reach those still trapped without food and water.
En las últimas 48 horas,
in the past 48 hours, we have deployed more than 1,500 military personnel, 1,800 police officers, and 2,700 members of the civil guard, as well as various groups of rescue specialists who are giving everything they can to rescue survivors, guarantee public security, and re-establish normality on the streets.
Well, many people have been shocked at the sheer scale of the disaster and crucially the speed with which it happened. The BBC's Bethany Bell has been speaking to one young student in Valencia.
Someone told me water is coming. Run as fast as you can, go to the last flat, and if you need to cut something, your ID, your cats, your pets, anything you need, cut it and go to the last flat and go there and wait, because we don't know what's going to happen. As I was coming up, the water was coming, follow me, really, really fast. It was so disgusting. It was.
What did you feel like?
I was feeling alone. I've been at home for 3 days with no light, no water, no phones, nothing. I couldn't call to my mom to tell her that I was feeling okay. And we didn't have food.
Do you know people who are missing?
Our neighbors are okay.
How do you feel now?
I don't know.
What does it look like?
I've never been in the war, but it seems like.
Well, whilst the outpouring of charity and assistance from volunteers has been impressive, many in Valencia want to know why the area wasn't better prepared ahead of the flood, with many questioning why warnings of the deluge and just how bad it could be were sent so late. Too late for most. Well, for the details, I've been speaking to Spanish journalist Miguel Morado, who began by telling me more about the number of people still missing.
Everybody expects this number of fatalities to rise substantially. There are at least 2,500 distress calls that have yet to be processed. And there are many areas in the region of Valencia which are not accessible yet.
I noticed the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has promised a lot more aid. The members of the army are going in, and civil groups as well, to try and help. But more details have been emerging over the past couple of days about the warnings of this weather coming in and whether or not the local authorities heeded them soon enough.
There was an alert after the weather services forecasted that there was going to be these huge torrential rains, but apparently the warnings arrived too late when people were already in trouble. And there's also complaints about the way in which the emergency services have operated. Many people believe it's been too slow, that they have not been efficient enough.
The weather service was putting out warnings very early on in the day. I mean, I'm reading in one article here as early as 7 o'clock in the morning. And yet the actual warnings from the regional government to people weren't issued till around 12 hours after that.
This is partly to do with the way in which Spain is organised. So regional governments have a lot of clout. In this case, emergencies and everything that has to do with alerts, civil protection, it's on the regional government. On the other hand, though, the central government is also blamed by the regional government for not helping the north.
So in terms of compensation for those people affected, and when you look at the pictures, I mean, it looks as if entire homes have been pretty much destroyed by these mudslides. Where can people hope to get any sort of financial help from? Will the insurance bodies pay up, or the government going to have to come in?
Private insurance, I guess that depends on what sort of insurance you sign. The central government has indeed said they are going to help with money for the reconstruction of the region of Valencia, as you would expect. Also, the European Union has promised to help Spain. That, of course, will take time, and it will be frustrating for many people because the scale of destruction is such that even with the best of intentions, reconstruction is going to be tough and is going to take time.
And is there a sense of building anger or frustration on the ground?
There is frustration, there is anger. I would say there's also, and most of all, desperation. Nobody expected something on this scale. This is a region which is used to this sort of torrential rains and flooding, but not on this scale. Nothing like this had happened for many, many decades. The problem is that this is also a very densely populated area. So housing has gone unrelenting for decades on areas that are floodplains.
I'm just seeing some pictures on the BBC website of the sheer numbers of volunteers that have turned out to try and help people. Is this terrible disaster having an impact across the country?
There's a wave of solidarity all throughout Spain. And as you say, thousands of people are going there trying to help people in villages and towns which have not been reached by the emergency services yet, really are grateful that they can bring them food and water.
And you mentioned, Miguel, that there's been this sort of tension between the regional leaders and the national leaders. And I just wonder, what do we know of the local president as a person, Carlos Mazón? And is he likely to be coming in for, you know, personal criticism for the way that he's handled this?
He's really under fire, not only by the opposition, but also his own party has some questions as the way he has acted. I expect him to be seriously under criticism in the coming days and weeks.
Spanish journalist Miguel Morado there. Here in the UK, months of wrangling to elect the new leader of the official opposition ended today with Kemi Badenoch being chosen by party members to lead the main opposition Conservative Party. Kemi Badenoch will replace former Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who announced his resignation from that role when he lost the general election to Keir Starmer's Labour Party in July. So what does all this mean for the future of the party and its plan to challenge the centre-left Labour government here in the UK? Let's speak to our UK politics correspondent, Rob Watson, who joins us live. Rob, first of all, what can you tell us about the winner, Kemi Badenoch? Fourth time the Conservatives have elected a woman as leader.
Well, you know, Rebecca, British politics is never boring, certainly not the last decade or so that we've been chatting and everybody listening to us. What can I tell you about? Well, the most interesting thing is not only is she the fourth woman, but she has made history. She is the first black person to lead a major political party in Britain. Now, in some ways, that's no big deal. You know, this is a multicultural, multiracial society. But in a funny sort of way, it's a big deal that it's not a big deal. So who is she? She's 44 years old. She has three young children. She was born in Britain, but to Nigerian parents. And actually, she spent her childhood in Nigeria. She only came to the UK at the age of 16 to do her studies. What is she? She's immensely feisty. I mean, I think one of her supporters said she's the kind of person who would cross the road to bite your ankles, even if you hadn't been winding her up. And as for her politics, well, she's very much a person of the right. She believes in a smaller state and on sensitive issues like multiculturalism. She's much more in favour of integration, assimilation, and the idea of lots of cultures living together.
Right. Well, as you say, Rob, it's been an eventful decade or so, hasn't it? Not least in the Conservative Party, in fact. What kind of opposition will they be now? It's been so divided, the Conservative Party. Is she a unity candidate?
Well, I think the first thing to get to is the task that she faces. I mean, it is worth reminding ourselves just briefly on the maths, Rebecca. So there are 650 MPs in the British Parliament. In 2019, the Conservatives had 365. They now have 121. I mean, it's their worst performance since 1832, even before my time. So they are fantastically unpopular. They've really got a long way to go to get back into power. I mean, is she a unifier? I guess what you could say is that the whole of the Conservative Party has moved to the right since the Brexit vote in 2016. It's not the same party that it was under David Cameron. But the funny thing is that even when everybody's on the right, or on the left, or wherever they are, you know what it's like, Rebecca. Politicians always find a way of managing to sort of disagree. And I think she will have a job on her hands unifying the Conservative Party.
Could she pose a problem for Sir Keir Starmer, though? You mentioned she's quite a colourful personality, quite a colourful speaker.
I think she could. I mean, just look, to state the obvious, that the demographics of this, you know, there's going to be a 60-year-old white man who describes himself as a socialist up against a feisty 40-odd-year-old black woman. They have a very, very different worldview. I think if nothing else, Rebecca, it's going to be watch this space. It should be interesting.
I'm sure it will be. Thank you so much. Rob Watson there, our UK politics correspondent, live. Now, it is the final few days before Americans vote, so we thought it might be useful just to spend a bit of time exploring the different terminology, let's be honest, jargon that may be creeping into some of our coverage over the next few days when it comes to describing the electoral process. And who better to turn to than the veteran US watcher and our own former BBC Washington correspondent Nick Bryant. He's recorded us a series of helpful US election explainers, and he's starting today with swing states.
Most American states tend always to vote either Republican or Democrat, which is why we refer to red and blue states, a colour scheme, incidentally, which came into effect at the 2000 election, when the US TV networks all decided to use on their graphics red for Republican and blue for Democrat. Swing or battleground states are places where both parties believe they can win. Their electoral college votes are up for grabs. So that's where the candidates focus their time and their money. The swing states shift from election to election. For much of this century, Ohio was a hotly contested battleground. Twice it voted for George W. Bush, and twice it voted for Barack Obama. But in recent elections, it's become reliably Republican. The same is true of Florida, which used to be the pivotal state, but which in the last two elections has become more red. This year, there are seven swing states. Two of them are southern states, Georgia and North Carolina. Two are in what's called the Sun Belt, Arizona and Nevada. And three of them are in the old industrial heartland of the Rust Belt, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. These are states where Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton in 2016, but which Joe Biden won back in 2020. Of the battleground states, Pennsylvania is the richest prize because it has the most electoral college votes, 19. It's also a classic bellwether. In the last 18 presidential elections, it's voted for the winner 15 times.
Nick Bryant, and there'll be more of those explainers coming from him across the next couple of days. Just three to go now until those elections in the United States. We'll be covering it from dawn to dusk when it happens, of course, here on NewsHour. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, as we've been reporting, there are just 3 days to go before the US election, which seems it could go either way at this stage. One of the big issues for both sides has been immigration and illegal migration across the southern border. A new documentary by US filmmaker Errol Morris is out. It's called Separated, and it focuses on immigration control under the last Trump administration in 2016. It's a stark account of how an estimated 4,000 children were taken from their parents who'd crossed into the US from Mexico under President Trump. The policy was implemented for about 2 months in 2018 before it was reversed amid widespread criticism. Here's a clip of the film.
Separation from your parent is a profoundly traumatizing event. But systematic separation of children from parents, officially, it wasn't happening. But it was happening.
Their version of stopping people from coming into the country was taking children away from their parents so that people wouldn't come.
Well, my colleague Julian Warraker spoke to Errol Morris and asked him what he wants people to take from this film.
These policies, which were instituted during the Trump administration, were quite terrible and should never be allowed to happen again. I don't know how to put it more simply than that. Immigration is at the center of our politics for whatever reason.
And do you think it's become a much more divisive issue in recent times in American politics? And if so, why?
Well, of course, it has become more divisive. And one would be misstating the case to say that immigration hasn't been a problem for decades. Growing up in America, I'm Jewish. I had always thought that immigration was what made America great. And Trump has turned it all around so that we should look at immigrants with disdain, suspicion.
When you look at public attitudes, and there are so many polls on this, as you know only too well, I was looking at one from July this year. This was a Gallup poll that said that 55% of Americans want less immigration, which is the highest figure on that subject since 2001. In other words, whether you like it or not, the wider American public has this level of anxiety as well.
And what am I supposed to say about it? We have that Statue of Liberty standing at the entrance.
I suppose the point I'm getting at is whether politicians therefore need to address it because the wider public seems to want them to.
Well, they certainly are addressing it. What strikes me as so terrible about the Trump era is how manipulable the electorate is. Say you say again and again and again and again ad nauseum how bad immigrants are. They're murderers, they're rapists, they're criminals. How easy it is to convince people that's the case when we should know better. We know that we're a country of immigrants.
Kamala Harris wants to sign into law what she would suggest is a pretty tough border compromise. In fact, it was put in front of Congress of late. And of course, she would say that Donald Trump objected to it, that he prevented Republicans from supporting it, and is therefore putting it back in front of the electorate in some shape or form as part of this presidential election campaign. So to a degree, she feels the need to at least appear quite tough on this issue as well, doesn't she?
Yes, I think that's a simple answer. She wants to be elected president of the United States, and there are compromises, as we all know, that politicians have to make in order to get elected.
And can you stomach that?
What choice do I have? If it's the choice between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, I can stomach a lot from Kamala Harris, to say the very least.
And to the Trump supporters who watch your film, and they're, I don't know, there may be some, there may not be many. What do you hope they will take out of it specifically?
I hope they learn something about these kinds of draconian policies. The separation of families at the border, you have to remember that part of this policy was taking infants, nursing infants away from their mothers. These policies had been considered by previous administrations, but rejected as draconian, as mean, as cruel. And it's possible to have borders without really beating up on people.
And when Donald Trump therefore says that he would stage the largest deportation operation in American history if
he wins...
We should
believe him.
You believe
him?
You think he's telling the truth on that, do you?
Well, it's odd to have the word truth associated with Donald Trump, but have it your way. Yes, I think he's telling the truth. I think he will try to institute those kinds of policies. Remember what happened the last time around.
Filmmaker Errol Morris speaking to Julian Waraker. Well, for a perspective from someone who operated President Trump's policy, Julian spoke to Ron Vitiello. He was the Deputy Commissioner of US Customs and Border Protection in 2018 and later became the Acting Director of US Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So was this policy cruel, as some suggest?
There was no design to be cruel to people. I don't know if this comes out in the movie or not, but we never intended to permanently separate families. And that was not the goal. It was not to separate families. The goal was to prosecute those who would continue to come under a condition in which the government really had very few tools to address it.
But the separation of families was an inevitable consequence of the tougher policy, was it not?
That was, in fact, what some of the outcomes were, yes.
And do you now regret that?
I wouldn't say regret. I think that we could have done a couple of things differently. I think we should have messaged more appropriately to the American public and given the folks that were in the pipeline that are losing their children every day to give them an additional piece of information, informed consent, if you will, when they took that journey or continued to take that journey, that they would be more informed of what some of the consequences would be.
So more information, but the consequence of the family separation, the children being effectively locked away, that would still be in place.
I think it would have minimized the impact to everyone that was involved. And let's not forget, you know, there are tens of thousands of people who are in that pipeline, children without their parents, children with their parents, that get separated every single day, whether the government does it, whether criminal cartels do it, whether human traffickers do it, or whether corrupt governments do it. It is a fact of the misery and the angst that people go through when they try to come into the country illegally.
Sure, but this was the choice of a democratically elected government to do this.
This was a range of tools that were authorized in order to try to contain what at the time was the largest surge on the southwest border that we'd ever seen before. Many of the people in that pipeline and in that surge were children that came alone and some children that came with their parents. And the government was overwhelmed. The facilities in which I was operating within or helping manage and lead were overwhelmed.
Ron Vitiello there, speaking to the BBC's Julian Waraker, bringing us to an end to this edition of NewsHour. From us all here, thanks for listening.